Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside segment. I'm Harold Fisher. An unarmed black man jogging in his community, gunned down by a white father and son. It happened more than 2 months ago, but arrests only made last week after video of the incident was leaked to the public. This case involving 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery is eerily similar to the killing of Trayvon Martin 8 years ago in Florida. Well, tonight, we examine the latest in this case and what it means for the current criminal justice climate. My guests are Justin Hansford, Executive Director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at the Howard University School of Law, and activist Reverend Alvin Herring, Executive Director of Faith in Action. If you have a comment or a question, and I'm sure you do, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining the conversation. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for having us.
Okay. Let me first start with some of the latest bits of information that have come down about this case. The Georgia Attorney General has appointed Joyette Holmes, Cobb County DA. She is the fourth prosecutor named in this case since the shooting happened back in February. But she is the first black woman named in this case, a relative novice to that position. She's only been there for 10 months, but does have experience on the bench in Georgia as well as a judge. Now, also, one of the other pieces of information is that the Attorney General is looking into having the federal, the Department of Justice look at hate crimes, as well as the investigation of why it took so long for the original prosecutors in this case to file charges. Lots of moving pieces, but let me start with you, Justin. Is this Trayvon Martin all over again?
Well, I think there are important parallels, and one of the questions we should ask ourselves is 8 years later, what has changed, not necessarily in America, but in our community? Have we come to a place where we are more sophisticated in our response? Are we now more clear that there is a role that prosecutors play in this, just as much as police officers and others in the criminal justice system? And how are we responding to the role that prosecutors are playing in these situations? And of course, if you think back to the Trayvon Martin case, the prosecutor in that case, Angela Corey, was unable to get that conviction in spite of all of the things that we heard, and there was a great deal of criticism as to whether the prosecutor even wanted a conviction. There, to the Mike Brown case, and we saw what happened with the prosecution there and the grand jury process. There's this idea that a prosecutor could indict a loaf of bread if they wanted to, but in certain cases, we see the discretion that prosecutors have. So what are we going to do about these prosecutors? How is our response going to be more sophisticated 8 years later? How are we going to use the knowledge that we have about the process and create real change? That's one of the questions that is still waiting to be answered.
But Reverend Herring, to that point, when you look back at the killing of Trayvon Martin, you only had the word of George Zimmerman, and there was some audio evidence recorded from a security camera. But here you have visual evidence. You have video evidence in the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. And it has been said that if it were not for the leaking of that video, that we probably would still be where we were before the arrests were made last week.
Oh, without a doubt. Firstly, let me thank you for having me on the show, and I thank
sure.
your brother who's also joining me. This is an important issue to be processing, and I appreciate the previous comment about, you know, asking the question, what have we learned and where are we now, some score 10 or more years beyond Trayvon. And I think that the basic parameters of this situation are very similar to situations that are playing out all over the country and have continued to play out all across the country. I think Trayvon's mother, I mean, not Trayvon, but Ahmaud's mother's summation of this is absolutely accurate. This was a lynching. This was vigilante justice or vigilante injustice. This was and is an unfolding story about the lack of deep regard for black life. And this is a story that too often is told regarding young brothers in this society who continue to essentially have a target on their backs, or certainly feel that way. I think that as it relates to the video, we heard our president this morning say that as he saw the video, he had questions about what took place off camera and what took place out of sight for several seconds during the video. That's a very kind of common refrain from those who are determined to not advocate for and support justice in cases like this. So does the video help? Absolutely. But does the video essentially guarantee that the wheels of justice will turn in the direction and the favor of this dear brother who lost his life and now a family and a community that grieves him, grieves his loss? We're not guaranteed that. And so, you know, we should still be very concerned and should still be very vigilant and should be speaking up and speaking out, insisting that justice be done in this case for Ahmaud, for his family, and frankly, for this country.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the Ahmaud Arbery case in Southeast Georgia and Black Lives Matter. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. The lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Michael, calling from Upper Marlboro. Michael, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I want to say that the first thing that doesn't set well with me is that I take a look back over my life. I'm 65 years old. I go back in time and I look at when think the racial justice that I had to deal with. And we're at a point in our lives now where we're dealing with situations. Let's look at Trayvon Martin.
Really quickly, I've got a lot of calls, Michael.
Okay,
so make your comments brief, please.
Let's look at Freddie Gray. In Baltimore, mm-hmm. and we look at this issue that took place here. This is not a place to ask questions as to what could have done or what could have been taking place. It gets to a point to time when you get tired of what's taking place and you decide to do something about it. And if you're not tired about it, you keep asking questions and you keep putting these filters out here. What are we going to take and do about our black males who are being killed unjustifiable, and at the same time the blue walls of justice taking come up and taking cover up for their own? It has to end at some point. So enough is enough. And we go from that point. And that's where we are right now. So what's going to take place 30 days from the day? It took 2 months for this stuff to come to light. And then you get all of your other individuals, your political leaders involved, Jesse Jackson, and Sharpton and so forth. But at the same time, where does it end? Where does it end? Where is the end?
You make an interesting point, Michael. Let me ask you about this, you know, Justin, and I hope that you can at least, you know, touch on this a little bit, because one of the things that keeps coming up in the case of Ahmaud Arbery is this issue about citizens' arrest. And honestly, I think the thing that most people know about that term comes from old movies where people talk about, I'm making a citizen's arrest. But this law is quite ancient when it comes to American history. Do you believe that that in and of itself is a valid defense?
I don't believe that it's valid because, one, is that in order to make a citizen arrest, you must first be able to witness a crime taking place that will place you or the people that you're in that community in jeopardy. And at the same time, if a person is just jogging and this person has been in this neighborhood and is from that neighborhood, how can you just assume, okay, what has been going through your mind? What have you been dealing with during the course of that time to say, okay, well, this individual looks suspicious. He looks there. He's been there in your community for years. In order for you to make a citizen arrest, you must be able to first actually see a crime in progress that you are able to ascertain or be able to bring under control. If not, you call law enforcement. Right. Now, you're going to take and just pull up and just have someone else video someone running through the neighborhood, and you say the person looked into a window. That doesn't justify the crime.
Right.
So now what we do, 2 months later, now these people are brought to justice or they are charged. The chances of them being convicted because of where they are, and I used to live in Georgia, it's not going to fly like that.
That's right. And I would add that if you look at the original DA who had some very odd response of recusing herself, admitting that she was in a conflict of interest because of the long time association with the former police investigator.
I would say this. Let me add this here.
Well, hold on. Go ahead, Reverend. Finish your point, and then you can go right ahead,
okay.
Justin.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Reverend, please go ahead.
Okay, sorry about that.
No. That wasn't me trying to break in. I absolutely support what the dear brother is saying. This is the whole notion of a citizen's arrest has to be in context to the witness of a crime and certainly something that would require as serious an intervention as to use a firearm, which exactly would be in relation to a crime where there was either the loss of life or the threat to life. This clearly isn't what's happened here. And having been born and raised in the South, although this is not contained only to the South, I was raised in a social milieu, in a context where these kinds of situations happen, unfortunately, way too frequently, and justice was often never done. And so the videotape is helpful, but I think most black folk in this country understand what's happened here, and we understand why justice has been so long delayed. And even with the evidence of a video, we also understand that nothing's guaranteed here. So we have to continue to fight, build power, speak up, act up if we have to. But we've got to keep this in front of the nation's attention, and they have to know that it's more than just folks who have notoriety or celebrity that are concerned here. It's everyday people who are insisting that justice be done for Aubrey. And we can't lose sight of this dear brother. He has to resonate for us. He has to occupy a place in our heart. Ahmaud Arbery was a beautiful young brother. He mattered to us. He matters now. His life was important to us. We can't lose sight of that, and we have to fight from that place.
I want to thank Michael for his phone call. Thank you so much for giving us a shout and expressing your views on this. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about the Ahmaud Arbery case in Georgia and Black Lives Matter. Where is the justice system right now for African Americans? There is also another case that we are going to get into on the other side of the break, and this one is indeed very, very similar, where we have a young woman, an EMT, who was shot by Louisville, Kentucky Metro Police officers during a raid on her home at about 1 o'clock in the morning on March 13th. It has been since discovered that the person they were looking for did not live there, and that her boyfriend, who was there at the time, who was a legal gun owner, exchanged gunfire with police officers. Again, a lot of moving parts. Breonna Taylor had no criminal record. There have been no arrests in this case, but she, of course, was killed. Again, another question this time as it relates to how police are policing in African-American neighborhoods. Certainly something to look at. We're going to drill down a little bit more as it relates to this particular case and Black Lives Matter. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. If you have a comment or a question about this, also a programming note, I will, after the broadcast tonight at 8:15, as I do every Tuesday, we are going to have another edition of HUR at Home. I'm going to have a chance to sit down very briefly with the CEO of the American Diabetes Association. Spoke to her on this program yesterday. We're going to see how she's doing at home and talk a little bit more about diabetes and COVID-19. Don't forget to join us at 8:15 on WHUR.com and YouTube and Facebook as well. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. This conversation continues on Sirius XM, Channel 141 in just a few seconds. Angela Stribling is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. This Black Lives Matter conversation is back in less than 30 seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our discussion about the Ahmaud Arbery case and Black Lives Matter. My guests are Justin Hansford, Executive Director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at the Howard University School of Law, and activist Reverend Alvin Herring, Executive Director of Faith in Action. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I want to talk more broadly about this Black Lives Matter issue, because it seems that we aren't taking any steps forward. We are just taking steps back, whether it's the Breonna Taylor situation in Louisville, Kentucky, or this situation as it relates to Ahmaud Arbery. Is there any chance that there needs to be a broader sense of looking at criminal justice reform or prosecutorial reform or the justice system more broadly? Your thoughts about that, Justin, because it just seems to me that you can't legislate racism. We've heard that for many, many years. And it just seems that, at least in the case of the Ahmaud Arbery situation, that's what we're looking at here.
Right. And I think that the question of criminal justice reform is something that, to be honest, even at the Thurgood Marshall Center at Howard, we've been making our focus. One of our goals this upcoming year is going to be with our clinic to fight against qualified immunity, which is something which allows police officers to avoid any sort of liability for their actions. That's a law which makes it so that, for example, in the case with Breonna, police officers don't have to worry about being sued and having to pay out of their own pocket for the mistake that was made by going to the wrong home. And similarly, for a prosecutor that is engaged in misconduct, there are also protections that make it difficult to bring lawsuits against them. So I think that the idea of reform is still there. What we can think about is digging deeper. The mistake that was made was to think that things like body cameras or civilian police review boards were going to be enough. And we allowed there to be a dynamic where accountability in terms of financial costs or putting people behind bars wasn't on the table, whether it was the police unions that fought back against that or whatever it was. They tried to find every other type of reform besides the reforms that really put fear into the hearts of the people who are engaged in the system, which is your money or your time behind bars. And so I don't think that the case for change is hopeless. I think, you know, the last caller, I actually didn't have a chance to respond. I think the caller was speaking, and I think it sounded like me. So
But please go right ahead. Yeah.
Right. But I wanted to just clarify that was an important point there, that, you know, on the case of, in this particular case with Mr. Aubrey, it was not a situation where they were able to argue that they were able to kill him because it was a citizen's arrest. The DA said they were going to argue self-defense. The citizen's arrest idea was what justified, in their minds, trying to chase him down. But it's the same sort of stand-your-ground self-defense law that you saw applied in the Trayvon Martin case, which will be used as a legal defense for these people down in Georgia. So there's really no legitimate way that someone can say that they're going to make a citizen's arrest and kill somebody. That's just pure vigilantism. And that's really difficult to justify in most places in this country. Even in a place like, you know, where we have this problem where these prosecutors are trying to create shields, we believe, for their colleagues, that vigilante, citizen's arrest law would only play a marginal role in their defense.
But what's the difference between vigilantism and citizen's arrest?
There's no difference at all. This is what I wanted to clarify that. This self-defense is what they would argue. They would argue self-defense, not citizen's arrest. So they have to prove that they were fear for their life or something like that. And that's, and to be honest, that's what scares me about that case, because I know they're going to have an opportunity, if, you know, they're given the leeway to do so in the court of law, to argue that when Mr. Aubrey was fighting for his life, as he should have been, they were in some way justified in being afraid, which is what they apply to, you know, these police officers when they have this standard of not just objective fear, but subjective fear. Like if a police officer feels afraid at any point, then they can use deadly force to defend themselves. And so if that applies here, then this is not over. We saw what happened in the Rodney King case. You know, we saw what happened in the Eric Garner case. We saw many cases where there was video, there was indictment, there was a court that got involved, even sometimes a trial, and it still ended up in acquittal. So this case is not over, unfortunately, and it's too early to celebrate just because we're at the stage of arrest at this point.
Mm-hmm. Reverend, did you have a comment that you wanted to add before I go back to the phones?
No, I really I support what Justin has said, and I think that the proper way to look at this is as he suggested, that this is vigilantism. That's a lawlessness that is pervasive. And it's a lawlessness that is unfortunately too often connected to patrolling or policing black people. I think when the previous caller asked, you know, what will ever change, I think what we all understand needs to change are the very systems, legal and otherwise, that go to the very heart of this country and the history of this country. The notion that black people should be and need to be patrolled, need to be forced inside the context of laws and policies that aren't just decided by government or decided by formal institutions, but are decided by the whim of everyday people, particularly those whose hearts are infected with systemic racism, that goes to the very core of the black experience in this country. And if we're going to see change happen, it is going to happen because we have insisted upon it, that we have organized ourselves, built the power that is sufficient, not just in the black community, but starting in the black community, and putting this very important moral question before this country. And that is, will it value all lives, especially the lives of black and brown folks? And in this case, will this country learn to value the lives of young black men and women? And that's the moral fight that we're in right now. It's a long fight. It's not over by a long shot. We've got to continue to work hard. But that's what's really at stake here, and that's the fight that we've got to join. And it can't just be those who have celebrity or who have a microphone, but it's got to be a fight that all of us are willing to fight.
Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. John calling from Virginia. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good evening. I just want to say I buttress and support the statements of the last speaker, and that's just exactly what I wanted to talk about, that reform starts with the system. Unfortunately, the law enforcement, certain sectors are viewed as a gang of poop. It's a cult. It's a gang. It's a clique. And as he said, what I would push for is that we have powerful, influential people of color in our community. It's unfortunate that we have been taught to not help each other, to build each other up or to support each other. The brainwashing has gone deep. But we have a lot of powerful people. We have the Black Caucus. And what we need to do is push for legislation that will, if we must be patrolled in our communities at this time, it should be our own people of color. I don't understand to this day, why is it that in our communities, are there not enough African-American law enforcement officers around to patrol our community, to be that friendly face, to help the grandmoms across the road and to help the little our loved ones who, you know, I just don't understand. Why do we have, you know, a complete diverse race in our community, but it's completely different in other communities? So reform is important, and I support that. From Oklahoma City in Greenwood, 1925, Oklahoma City, the first time ever in the history of this nation when the Air Force, the United States Air Force, was used on its own people, was used in Oklahoma City when they decimated that whole community that was thriving. It was called Black Wall Street.
Yes.
So yeah. We this is not new, and everybody is saying push for change. It starts with our Congress. With our senators, our leaders, we can do it.
Okay.
LeBron James is already doing a great job. Out of his own pocket, he's paying for lawyers and all kind of things that he's doing to help.
Well, John, thank you so much for your thoughts about that. You know, one of the other things when you talk about race and you know, white supremacy and the issues regarding how black bodies are seen in communities around, you know, this country by people who are not black. And I make specific reference to something that came up just last week, I believe it was, about the after the arrest of Greg and Travis McMichael, the men who are accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery. There was a GoFundMe page that popped up. And one of the things that really caught my eye, because it says in a brief statement, it says, you know, these two God-fearing men were only trying to protect their neighborhood. But then the second sentence says, this area has had a string of break-ins, and this man fit the description and did not comply with simple commands. It is that phrase, and did not comply with simple commands. And it raises the question, not only as it relates to whether it's vigilante justice, whether it's about citizens' arrests, or where we are in the broader justice system, but this is about being a black person, specifically a black man in America. And if you are walking down the street and a white guy, quote unquote,
commands you or attempts to command you to do something, then, you know, God forbid that, you know, we are beyond where, you know, anybody should be able to command anybody to do anything on the street. But even more to this point, that phrase to me speaks of specifically white supremacy, Justin.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I think that's a wonderful point, because we have been, in a sense, conditioned to adhere to that rhetoric when it's involving police officers, with this idea that they can command or issue commands at people at any time, at any place, without clear justification, and they should be followed. And then when you have people who appoint themselves as Neighborhood Watch in the George Zimmerman case, or a former police officer, and who find themselves thinking that they can exercise that same authority, that ideology, that way of thinking, goes out into the community, and it's racialized. I would love, I mean, as you said, imagine a black man walking into that neighborhood and giving commands, simple commands, to people, you know, switch roles in that case, you know, and then saying, well, they didn't follow my simple command, so I had to open fire. It would sort of be a crossing of your wires in your brain to even think of that dynamic. So the language of authority and power is racialized, and the policing of our communities is an instance of it, where there's the veneer of law behind it. But even police are not really in a position to just give commands to anyone walking down the street at any time. You're not signed up into the army when you're born in the country as a citizen and have to take commands from anyone at any time because of their assumption of authority. So I think that is, so there are Black Lives Matter activists who talk about the abolition of police and prison abolition and police abolition. It sounds very radical and out of the realm of possibility, but I think what they're really getting at in the short term is changing our way of thinking about what is the right way to keep our communities safe, and you know, what is the way to interact with each other that is based in justice and the creation of a beloved community, and not based on authoritarianism, which ends up being racialized in the way our society is designed.
Well, I take issue with you about the police, because we know what would happen if that command in the form of a cruiser with blue and red lights pulls up behind you, and then you decide, well, you know, they don't have the authority to command me by blue and red lights to pull over. That could end up in a very unfortunate situation, and so I take issue with that. But I will say that why would I or you or Reverend Herring or any black person, for that matter, stop when some random white person or random any person who does not identify themselves as law enforcement ask you to stop? And I think that goes back to that, you know, to that argument of the expectation that black people are supposed to do what you say if you are a white person, which appears to be the case here. But I think, again, more broadly, when you were talking about, you know, the authority of the police, as we have seen in the case of the young woman in Louisville, Kentucky, I think that is going to raise so many more questions, because it appears, based on the reporting, that that was a very deadly a mistake. Let me go back to the phone lines. Anthony, calling from District Heights. Anthony, yes. Thanks for hanging on. What's on your mind?
Yes, I would like to first say that Black lives, they don't matter, as we can witness to the killing of young Black men at any time. But I would just want to say that Blacks and whites and those of us who disagree with this useless killing and violations of the law, we need to organize. We need to do something. I mean, this stuff happens too frequently where we just say, okay, we want to talk about it. No, we have laws on the book that, like initiative referendum, that remove governors, prosecutors, congressmen from their positions when people come together and vote them out. And as far as us talking about it, it just should be us organizing the people to remove these folks, because it's too prevalent. And at this point, it's just like we don't have nothing else we can do, but we have laws to do that, to straighten out Georgia or wherever. And if we don't have it, if we don't have the people, we can work on constantly trying to get the people together to put these referendums on the ballot to have these people removed permanently.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your passion and your phone call, Anthony. Thank you for that. I did want to ask Reverend Herring, do you believe that the appointment of a Black prosecutor in this case will make a difference? I mean, she's a woman, but I'm not even, you know, from my perspective, man or woman, it doesn't matter to me. But do you believe that, you know, we've had the first prosecutor was a woman, the second prosecutor was a man, and he did something really unusual in that when he recused himself, he wrote a letter to I believe it was the next prosecutor explaining why he did not arrest the McMichaels. And then the third prosecutor,
right,
whom we saw last week at the press conference with the director of the Georgia Bureau of Investigations, he said earlier this week, I believe it was yesterday or Sunday, that this case was too big for him. It was the caseload was going to be too much, and that somebody needed to be appointed with more resources. And now we have Joyette Holmes, the Cobb County District Attorney, a Black woman. Do you think it's going to make a difference in prosecuting this case?
Well, firstly, I think we should all pray for Sister Holmes. She has an enviable task ahead of us, because she's not only has the responsibility and the charge to insist that justice be done in the courtroom and justice through the laws that are the prevailing laws of the land, but she also has to deal with a tidal wave of public opinion in Georgia that may not support her aggressive prosecution of these two individuals who, at least by virtue of the citizen's account in the video, took legal matters into their own hands and murdered Ahmaud Arbery. I pray that she will be up to the task, but I also understand that that adjustment alone, insisting upon a new prosecutor, will not necessarily insist or ensure that justice is done. To the point that your previous caller made, this is a moment where we have to organize, where we have to insist through our own efforts by raising our voices, by remembering and reminding everyone that Ahmaud Arbery is not just, this is not just a case. It's not just a legal trial that will take place regarding two men who took his life. But Ahmaud Arbery was our son, was our brother, was a dear member of our community, was someone who mattered to us, whose life had context and texture to it, who brought us joy and who reminded us of the beauty of Black people. you know, one of the things that I can hear in the voices of your callers is this sense of outrage. And we should be outraged. We should be livid in every way that word insists, that what has happened here is a violation of what should be right. It's a violation of what should be just. It is immoral. It is wrong. And it is evidence of evil. And that outrage should lead us not just to lament, not just to grief, and not just to rage, but should lead us to systematically build in our own space, in our own communities, and across communities, the kind of public power that insists that justice be done. The last thing I'll say in relation to your question is I think some of the outrage that we are experiencing in this moment is connected to a term I used earlier, and that is these two white individuals were patrolling their streets. And that patrolling of black people reminds us all of a time in history. In this moment, this case is not disconnected from history, a time when black folks' lives were patrolled. I'm reminded of historian Gary Potter, who spoke about slave patrols and said that the job of the slave patroller was to chase down, apprehend, and return to their owners runaway slaves, number one. Number two, the job was to provide a form of organized terror to deter slave revolts. And number three, the job of the slave patroller was to maintain a form of discipline for slave workers who were subject to summary justice outside of the law. This reminds us of that, and for good reason. Ida B. Wells would probably put a sign out that said a black man was lynched on the day that Ahmaud Arbery's life was taken, and she would be right.
I appreciate that. I have a few minutes left, and I think that when we look at the issue of, you know, of justice for, you know, for black people, and as I said at the top of this story, we all, no matter what color you are, we want our neighborhoods to be safe. You know, whether it is, you know, east of the river here in Washington, D.C., or Louisville, Kentucky, or in Brunswick, Georgia, or Prince George's County, certainly. And there are remedies, however imperfect those remedies may be, for making sure that our communities are safe. You pick up the phone, you call 911, and you hope that your tax dollars, your hard-earned tax dollars go into effect, and that the police come and they do their jobs. But beyond that, whether it's a neighborhood patrol in Sanford, Florida, or what happened here in Brunswick, I think this is sending a chill not only down the backs of black people, of black men, but I think this is a cautionary tale for the justice system. And I would argue that all of the publicity surrounding this could very well be good or problematic, Justin, for this case. What do you think?
I think I agree in 100% agreement with this idea that we must find other ways to keep our communities safe, whether the patrol happens from a self-appointed neighborhood patrol, or we've seen, you know, white police officers patrolling black communities, and we see a similar outcome. All of these patrols are not the best method for keeping our communities safe. And as the Reverend said, I think that the people have to have a movement that finds an alternative method for keeping the community safe that doesn't build on the model created during enslavement of a slave patrol model. Yeah. And that moment is the moment I dream of. That's the moment that I hope that this publicity will spark and inspire. I do think that the publicity from the media
will politicize this case, and in that particular region, I'm not sure that the politicizing of the case will lead to more justice or less justice in terms of the jury that might get involved or the prosecutor's decision. And of course, I'm speaking from the perspective of someone who was in Ferguson and saw what happened with that prosecution when publicity came into a small town in Missouri, and the prosecutor became that much more hardened to prove a point.
Yeah.
And so we don't know what's going to happen here in that case.
Well, I want to thank both of you, Justin Hansford and Reverend Alan Herring, for talking to us. While we are still in the midst of this pandemic, I urge you to stay safe. But in the context of this conversation, I urge you to stay safe if you are jogging or walking or parking or standing on your front porch or going to church or just living your life. Please be safe. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you, dear brother.
Thank you. Thank you and blessings.
Absolutely. That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, May 12th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.